Stockholm, Paris, Berlin, Kiev, Ljubljana, Bratislava, Amsterdam, Bucharest,
Hello and welcome to Network Europe. I'm Richard Walker. Coming up on the programme, riots in Paris bring back memories of the car-burning orgy of 2 years ago, but President Sarkozy's in no mood for compromise. Spanish police need all the information they can get as they try to stop massive new shipments of cocaine entering Europe.
What's really hot now is West Africa, Cape Verde, Senegal, and that area.
And the EU's Galileo satellite project limps towards liftoff, but will it be better than the American system, or the Chinese one, or the Russian one?
Turn around when possible, so that you will be facing in the opposite direction from the direction in which you're directing your vehicle now.
All of that and more, plus I'll announce the winner of this month's quiz. Stay tuned. And it's not just the Kaiser Chiefs predicting a riot. In France, many say it's been on the cards for some time. Dozens of police officers were injured on Monday and Tuesday during clashes with youths in a northern Paris suburb. The intensity of the violence took everyone by surprise. Molotov cocktails were thrown and even shotguns were fired, putting several policemen in hospital. The catalyst for all this was the death on Sunday of two teenage boys who were killed when their motorcycle collided with a police car. The violent reaction from sections of the community has rekindled memories of the nationwide rioting 2 years ago when the protest act of choice was car burning. Radio France International Sarah Elsas has been following the story for Network Europe and she joins me now. Sarah, with these riots in Paris being sparked by the deaths of two teenagers, it's very similar to what happened 2 years ago, isn't it?
Well, it's similar, but it's also not quite the same, because in this case, the police were very directly involved. The police and the motorcycle with the kids on it collided. I mean, that this was, and of course, everyone has a different version of what happened, from the kids who saw it, you know, 20 minutes after the fact, to the neighborhood residents, to the police, to the government. And I mean, it's clear that the intensity of the reactions of the deaths is, it's not so much of the event itself, but this deep resentment to the police, and it's probably even bigger than that. But there's an official investigation into what actually happened on Sunday. But ultimately, I think it's not really about what happened, but about the perception of what happened. The relationship between the police and this neighborhood, and in general in the suburbs and these housing project neighborhoods, the relationship with the police is so bad that even if the truth comes out, and even if, you know, the police are exonerated, people won't believe it on some level. No one will believe it. And in fact, our reporter, Brent Gregston, went to Villiers-le-Bel, which is where this all happened, and he met there a retired police officer, and he sums it up pretty well.
What's clear is that there are neighborhoods where the police has trouble entering, and systematically, when there's an incident, it's seen as the fault of the police. So even if the conclusion here is that the police didn't do anything, that will always be contested by the young people and their families.
I just wonder, is this really about the relationship of local people and the police, or is it a catalyst for a deeper social problem?
Well, that's the 100 million euro question there, I guess. I do think that there is a big problem between the relationship between the police and people in these neighborhoods, but maybe that is sort of the tip of the iceberg. And the police are almost scapegoats on some level of sort of a deeper social problem. In 2005, there were riots all over the country. And afterwards, there were promises from the government, and some money had been spent on these poor neighborhoods. You know, there were promises of reforming things and changing things. But no one necessarily saw it. And I do think what's probably needed is a more systematic overhaul. And that definitely hasn't been done. But it really seems like the problem is more than housing projects. You've got employment discrimination on a systematic level in a job market that's already has really high unemployment. And while that doesn't necessarily affect the teenagers who are directly involved in this violence, it does affect sort of the mood that they're growing up in and foments, I guess, the disappointment and the anger.
Now, President Sarkozy arguably made his name a couple of years ago with the way he reacted to the riots then. What's his reaction been this time?
Well, his reaction is pretty consistent, I guess. He seems to be rejecting the theory that these riots were the outpouring of a deeper anger, like a lot of people have been saying, and feeling of being disenfranchised. He said, no. He spoke to a group of 2,000 police officers on Thursday, where he stressed that these riots had nothing to do with social problems.
What happened in Villiers-le-Bel has nothing to do with a social crisis. It has to do with hoodlums. If a ruffian comes back to his housing project after each incident as a hero, that's an insult to those who arrested him. It's an insult to his future. It's an insult to the Republic.
The insults are flying then in Nicolas Sarkozy's version of events.
Yeah. I mean, what you see here is Sarkozy is trying to make this into sort of a contained incident of a few hoodlums, and he's not really recognizing that in a lot of these neighborhoods, the anger and frustration just exploded through these teenagers directed towards police officers. But the impression I'm getting is it's more just widespread anger, again, which doesn't excuse it, but maybe explains it a little. One thing to remember, as we said earlier, Sarkozy kind of got elected because of his attitudes towards the riots in 2005. He was interior minister before and during those riots, and he kind of gained a reputation of being tough on crime, zero tolerance. He famously called the rioters scum. So now he sort of has to pull a fine balance, right? Because he got elected on that, so he has to still continue to appeal for the people who elected him for saying that, basically. But he also has to help, you know, you can't have these kind of situations continuing. And I do think, though, that one of the ways that might help, I mean, one of Sarkozy's mandates was to reform the economy, to increase jobs, reduce unemployment. And on some level, I think if he manages to pull that off, it may solve a lot of these problems, because a lot of the anger comes from unemployment, from discrimination. And I mean, if there are more jobs for everyone, then there's less discrimination. It may not solve the deep-seated unrest, but it would be a start, I guess.
Thanks a lot, Sarah. Sarah Elsas in Paris there.
Thunderbolts and lightning, very, very frightening me.
Galileo, Galileo.
Take the second right.
Turn around when possible, so that you will be facing in the opposite direction from the direction in which you're directing your vehicle now.
My name's Sylvia. Why don't you come with me? I'll help you reach your destination.
You want to go somewhere? Step into my limo. I'll take you on a trip you can't refuse.
Just some of the ways you can be guided by voices as you navigate your way around in a car. In case you haven't come across this yet, it's called GPS, and it's a system of satellites that pinpoint your car and then beam information to the voice under your dashboard, which in turn tells you to turn left or whatever. The EU's Galileo project's supposed to rival America's GPS satellite navigation system. What you heard just now was a selection of the voices you can choose for the GPS computer to use as it barks orders at you. Now, this being the EU, there's been terrible wrangling about how the project's being funded, and the whole thing's been stalled for months until now. Joining me in the studio is Network Europe and Radio Netherlands Worldwide Brussels correspondent Vanessa Mock, who's been following the story for us. Vanessa, it helps you not get lost when you're driving, but you don't spend billions putting dozens of satellites into space just for that, do you?
GPS is the main thing. I mean, it's all about prestige. It's all about being at the forefront of this new technology. But this is GPS really with a difference, because there's going to be all sorts of new applications which companies are now working on. So, for instance, it's going to be a lot more precise, like actually be able to calculate your position to the meter. So, for instance, if you're driving into one of the big capital cities, it's a Saturday, it's full, jam-packed, the roads are full, and you want to know where to park, then the GPS system, Galileo, should be able to tell you where to find a parking spot and take you there and calculate exactly how long it's going to take to get you there. Then there's all sorts of, for instance, search and rescue operations, services that will be on there. Also, for instance, for the elderly, they're working on some sort of beeper system whereby if an elderly person feels unwell, they can just press this and the emergency services will know exactly where they are and be able to get them there and then. So all sorts of kind of high-tech applications.
What if it's cloudy?
I don't think it should matter. I think the technology should be high tech enough to be able to break through any cloud system, because we're talking about 20 satellites for all that money.
Now, for all that money, and it is costing a lot of money, isn't it? And I suppose because of that, but also because it's the European Union and there has to be wrangling about every big decision that's made, and even small decisions. There's been an awful lot of wrangling going on for a very long time, and we're at the end of it now. It's being sorted out now-ish, isn't it?
Now-ish, yeah. We're sort of at the end of it. Of course, it still has to be approved by the European Parliament. But basically, the predicted cost of the Galileo project is 3.4 billion euros. A big, big chunk of that, actually a third of the total cost of the project, is now going to come from unused farm subsidies. This was completely against the wishes of a lot of member states, including Germany especially, which said it should come from the national member states. You shouldn't be using unused money because that should be going back to the governments.
I'm curious about all these unused farm subsidies, but I suppose it's a whole different topic.
It's a whole different thing. It's all to do with the global grain prices that have gone up. So basically, European farmers have been a lot better off this year.
We'll all sleep easier tonight with that knowledge, won't we? It's a very expensive project, and there is already a system, the GPS, American GPS system, up there in space doing this stuff. So why do we need it?
Well, it's a question of prestige. It's a question of European ambitions to really start putting Europe back at the front of technological innovation. They say it's going to generate lots of jobs, but most of all because there are still fears that the US GPS system is primarily, or originally was devised as a military tool. And so what we had during the Afghanistan war and the first war in the Gulf was that the US Defense Ministry actually took over the GPS system. That wasn't so big a problem at the time, but now that you have millions and millions and millions of users across Europe, across the world, actually using GPS, if that happened again, which the Americans said it wouldn't, but the Europeans are not very reassured, if that were to happen again, then you would be left with potentially millions of people in their cars completely stranded and unable to sort of direct find their way home. So they want a backup thing. But of course, a lot of it is about kudos. It's about prestige.
Right. How prestigious is it going to be if the whole European Galileo project is overtaken by the Chinese equivalent, because they've got one in development and so have the Russians?
That's a really, really huge question mark that's looming over the project. A lot of critics are saying we're just signing a blank check for a technology that will be completely obsolete by the time it finally gets started in 2013. We've got the Russians who say that their GLONASS system will be operational in 2 years' time for commercial applications. They've got over a dozen satellites up there. The Chinese are working very, very, very fast on building their own system. Then you've got the Americans who are massively upgrading their own GPS system.
It's just a thought, but it occurred to me, is it democracy that's holding Europe back? Because the Chinese and the Russians, they don't have quite such advanced democracies, and they can make decisions an awful lot quicker, can't they? Whereas Europe, we have all the wrangling. It goes on for years.
It does go on for years. And I think when it comes to technology, it really, really shows that Europe is unable to keep up the pace, really. I mean, we already had years of debates about whether the bill for this should be stumped up by private companies. Then the ministers couldn't agree. Then the technology. I mean, and now, there's already concerns that the bill will go way beyond 3.4 billion. The total bill could be up to 12 billion. And then where would the money come from then? So it could still get held up, and the Europeans are really going to, if they really want to get this off the ground, if pardon the pun, then they're really, really going to have to start working now and to anticipate technological changes and getting the technology up to speed.
Thanks very much. Vanessa Mock from Radio Netherlands Worldwide. The Swedish government sparked a bad-tempered debate this week over how schools should deal with the era of communist history in Europe and Russia. Sweden's education minister wants to make classes on communism and the Soviet regime's crimes obligatory. Some opponents say that by setting a rigid history syllabus for schools is itself quite authoritarian. Stalin would approve if the subject was something other than his reviled gulags. Radio Sweden's Alexander Hirschfelder has more.
Do you know what a gulag is? If you do, you know more than 90% of Sweden's pupils. According to a research carried out in early May this year, Swedish youngsters know very little of communism and the crimes that have been committed in its name. Almost half of Sweden students are convinced that no, or at least very few people were killed in the Soviet Union because of political reasons. And every fifth young Swede believes that communism is a democratic system. These devastating figures caused an outcry in Sweden. Nearly everybody agreed that something had to be done about the extreme lack of historical knowledge. The question merely was, what should be done? Eskil Frank, head of the Living History Forum in Stockholm, an authority that was established in 2003 in order to deal with the Holocaust, received the governmental order to broaden the focus from Nazi crimes to communist crimes.
It was worse than I thought, and I think we have to repair it in a sense, yes, we do. We have been working very hard to produce knowledge about Holocaust. Now it's time to produce knowledge about Gulag for Swedish pupils. I think it's very much the same type of task as we had concerning Holocaust. We are dealing with it in the same way, but now it seems as it has a touch of politics than the question about Holocaust had.
A political touch? Indeed. Commentators around the country maintained it was striking that once the new center-right coalition government had come into power, they ordered the Living History Forum shift its emphasis from the Holocaust to communism. Are the new ministers in office to fight an ideological battle in order to bring any kind of leftist thinking into discredit? Be it pure coincidence or not, Sweden's left party was the first political power to object the government's plan to concentrate on communism in general. Now the left party accused the education minister of governmental interference. Rosanna Dinamarca is a member of Riksdagen, the Swedish parliament.
For me, it's very important that we have a free research in Sweden and also that we can depend on the teachers, in this case, that are teaching history. We should not ride from the governmental side what the teachers should teach or not. I think that is dangerous for democracy.
Despite the public outrage already caused by his comments, Education Minister Jan Björklund went a step further and announced that communism was to be set on the agenda of every school. Communist crimes are to be an obligatory subject for every young Swede. So it all sums up to one question. When is a free society more endangered? When its teachers are entitled to teach whatever they want, or when the government tells the teachers what to do? Sweden's center-right coalition government has already positioned itself on the question, to the explicit resentment of opposition politicians like Rosanna Dinamarca.
We should learn something from the Soviet Union, for example, is that the government should not be influencing what the researcher, for example, or the teachers should teach in school, but to really develop a democratic society. No matter what the subject is.
The first nationwide campaigns dealing with the dark side of communism will start off in March next year, and maybe many young people will finally get to hear what a gulag actually is, the Soviet version of a concentration camp.
And now to another European nation where a few politicians are taking on the task of educating the masses. Actually, the country is the Netherlands, where I am now. And it's in fact one man. You might have heard of him. His name's Geert Wilders, and journalists usually put the word controversial in front of his name. Mr. Wilders is known as an Islam basher, and he's back in the headlines this week for making a film denouncing Islam and arguing for the Quran to be banned. Straight away, parallels are being drawn with the highly controversial film Submission, made by murdered Dutch filmmaker Theo van Gogh and writer Ayaan Hirsi Ali.
O Allah, as I lie here wounded, my spirit broken, I hear in my head the judge's voice as he pronounces me guilty. The sentence I have to serve is in your words. The woman and the man, guilty of adultery or fornication, flog each of them with 100 stripes.
A clip from the film Submission, and that film pushed the issue of Muslim integration in Holland up the political agenda, especially after Van Gogh's murder by an Islamic extremist. Here's the maker of the new film, MP Geert Wilders, explaining what he aims to achieve.
I believe that the Quran is a book that still today inspires people to do the most terrible things, from terroristic acts to Sharia-like punishments. So what my aim is to show the people that this is not only a book that 1500 years ago was taken seriously, but is still taken seriously today, is still put into reality today. And I hope that beside words, that if you combine the message with images, that it will make the message even more clear than it perhaps was until then.
Well, to pick over the enigma, that is Geert Wilders, Radio Netherlands Worldwide correspondent in The Hague. John Tyler joins me now. John, Geert Wilders is always controversial, so this isn't a totally surprising move from him. Do you think he sets out to court attention, or is the attention just a byproduct of what he says?
Well, it's definitely a little of both, although you have to say that he is definitely after the attention. It's been quiet from his camp for, probably 4 to 6 weeks now, and it's about time for another big piece of news from Geert Wilders.
I interviewed Mr. Wilders once in the street, and he was surrounded by security people holding bomb blast shields. So the threat to his safety is obviously taken seriously, and he's obviously serious about inspiring people to threaten his safety. He seems to want to make people believe that he's a man on a mission to tell the world about Islam.
Well, it's really hard to see what exactly his motivations are, because indeed he does seem to become more and more extreme with what he's talking about. He really does have something against Islam, and that's becoming clearer and clearer. He doesn't hide it himself at all. But another thing about Geert Wilders is everyone talks about the freedom of expression in the Netherlands, and everyone wants to protect it. But of course, that's a lot easier to do when you're always surrounded by bodyguards. And the question is if Geert Wilders would dare to do what he's doing if he's not being so well protected. But when I did ask him about whether he was concerned, you know, about the effects of what he was going to be doing, this is what he had to say.
I have to do what I have to do, and I have to say what I believe. If you are a politician and you have to speak out your ideas, you cannot stop expressing yourself only by the thought that some people might oppose it or might become angry. So once again, it's not my aim, but if it's the effect, it really is not my problem.
A short while ago, John, we heard a little clip from the movie Submission by Theo van Gogh, who was murdered. Do you think Geert Wilders is looking to have a similar sort of impact? He's got the security around him that Theo van Gogh didn't have, but is he looking to make that sort of splash?
I think he wants to make an even bigger splash. I think the film that he's talking about, if it really comes to pass, what he said he's doing, is going to be much more far-reaching than Submission was. Submission was only 11 minutes long, and it was made by Ayaan Hirsi Ali, the former Somali, then Dutch politician, along with Theo van Gogh. And Ayaan Hirsi Ali wanted to show that Islam could be hostile to women. Now, what Geert Wilders wants to do is show that the entire book, the Quran, is a bad influence. So it seems to be a much broader reach.
But nonetheless, you expect him to remain a fringe politician.
Well, I really wouldn't call him fringe even now, actually. And it's a little bit scary how much of a following he has. So you absolutely cannot write Geert Wilders off. He's pushing the envelope, but he definitely seems to have a lot of people in the Netherlands who agree with him.
Thanks very much, John Tyler there from Radio Netherlands Worldwide.
I'm dreaming of a white Christmas.
Just like it'll be a white Christmas for more European partygoers than ever before. Cocaine abuse is on the rise across Europe, and particularly in Spain. So far this year, Spanish police have intercepted 5 shipments, each holding over 3 tons of the drug. With such high supply, prices have dropped and the Iberian Peninsula is awash with a narcotic that keeps you up all night. Deutsche Welle's Jerome Sokolowski reports now from Madrid's Barajas airport, one of the key entry points for smugglers from Latin America.
A plane from Caracas, Venezuela has just landed, and workers are dumping suitcases on the conveyor belt. A police dog trainer orders a Belgian shepherd to inspect the bags. The dog sniffs a bag and bites down on it. The trainer orders him to let go.
Out!
Then he discreetly marks it and lets it roll further on the conveyor belt into the arrivals hall. Out in the hall, passengers are waiting for their luggage. A few look nervous. When one of them, a woman with short black hair, picks up her bag, several plainclothes agents cut her off and order her into a side room with an X-ray machine. The suitcase goes through the machine, and the agent watching the monitor almost can't believe what he sees. He tells the passenger to open the bag. The bag is completely empty, except for the hidden compartments all around the insides. The policeman sticks his hand in and takes out sealed bags filled with white powder. Do you know what this is? This is cocaine, he says to the passenger. He places her under arrest, and another policeman leads her away. Less than a minute later, another passenger is brought in from the Caracas flight, and it's the same story, an empty bag lined with cocaine. Sergeant Luis Queja heads the airport anti-narcotics squad for the Guardia Civil, Spain's paramilitary police force.
In almost 30 years, I've seen it all. We've caught people with drugs in wheelchairs, bicycles, inside their bodies, dogs, in animal cages, in tropical fruits, even in carnation stems.
He used to be impressed by the smuggler's ingenuity.
But lately, I have to say that the sense of ingenuity is being lost, because now there's just loads of it coming. Sometimes they don't even bother to make hidden compartments.
Already this year, police at Madrid's Barajas airport have seized more than 2.5 tons of cocaine. That's about as much as in all of last year. Spain is the main entry point for European cocaine. In its 2006 annual report, Europol estimated that 250 tons enters the European Union each year via maritime shipments, air freight, and airplane passengers. Now the country also happens to be located at a pivotal point for a new smuggling route that goes via West Africa, says Sergeant Queja.
What's really hot now is West Africa, Cape Verde, Senegal, and that area. You get containers of drugs unloaded there, and it's brought to Europe.
A few weeks ago, police intercepted two powerboats off the northwestern Spanish coast of Galicia with more than 3 tons of cocaine on board. Experts say the increased flow of cocaine has brought down the price of the drug and made it available to a cross-section of people. In Spain, partying hard is part of the youth culture, and cocaine is easily available at discos on Ibiza or the Costa del Sol. It's 9 a.m. on a Sunday morning, and this after-hours disco in Madrid is packed. On the dance floor, a young dancer named Ángel says practically everyone here is on cocaine or other stimulants, so they don't have to sleep.
They start partying Friday night, continue Saturday morning, Saturday night, Sunday morning, and Sunday night. There are so many clubs, so if you really want, you can go the whole weekend until Monday morning, non-stop.
According to the United Nations, cocaine use in Spain has surpassed that of the United States. Experts worry that the problem could get worse around Europe because of the cheap availability of the drug and the new smuggling routes reaching the continent. Jerome Sokolovsky, Deutsche Welle Radio, Madrid.
6 weeks after polls voted the Conservative Law and Justice Party out of office, Poland's new government is in place with Prime Minister Donald Tusk at the helm. So what does the Polish man in the street expect from the new leadership? And what does the new cabinet stand for? Michael Kubicki of Polish Radio External Services reports.
It's a coalition government of the victorious Civic Platform and the Polish Peasant Party, the smallest of the four parties in the parliament. Attaching a label to this cabinet is not an easy task. The previous Law and Justice government was called Conservative. This one doesn't differ from it that much on ideological and moral issues. And even though Prime Minister Donald Tusk has long been committed to liberal market reforms, in his policy speech to the Parliament, he avoided using the word liberalism. The key words of his 3-hour-long address were trust and freedom. Most Polish analysts were disappointed with the address. Stanisław Janecki of the weekly Prost.
It was too long, too unclear, and without any hierarchy. If you are a politician, you should have 3-4 aims important for the country and for the prime minister. If you have 30 or 40 important tasks, they are not important.
In his address, Donald Tusk promised pay rises for public sector workers. He pledged to lower taxes, speed up privatization, and reduce the budget deficit. But he didn't say how he was going to do it. One of the few specific points outlined by Mr. Tusk concerned the EU Charter of Fundamental Rights and Warsaw's refusal to sign it. His remarks on the issue won an overwhelming support of those who a few weeks ago had been at the helm of government.
Going to Brussels and Lisbon to sign the EU treaty, I'll respect the results of the negotiations by my predecessors. This means joining Britain in a protocol limiting the application of the Charter of Fundamental Rights.
Poland negotiated the Charter opt-out during the EU treaty talks, and President Lech Kaczyński had threatened he would veto any attempt to give up the opt-out. Prime Minister Tusk made it clear that even though he supports the Charter, he would do his best to avoid any threat to the ratification of the EU reforming treaty in the Parliament. According to Mariusz Ziomecki of Superstacja Television, this is not a good message to the EU, which waited for a clear statement of a fundamental change in Warsaw.
The first specific signal is that perhaps the change is not so fundamental. It reminds everyone that, in fact, this is another centrist, rightist government.
The government's stand on the Charter of Fundamental Rights may not be a good message for the EU, but in Poland itself, no previous government had aroused so much hope for change as the present cabinet. 60% of Poles think that it's going to be a good government that will stay in power for the entire 4-year parliamentary term. But they haven't forgotten the promises made during the election campaign.
There are many promises made, and I hope they will keep their promises and they will make everything connected with Euro 2012 ready for time, because now we're having big problems with that.
I do believe strongly that the economy will go on, that it will not be influenced that much by the political statements and so on, because it has its own course, and I believe that it will be good.
I travel quite a lot, and I'd say that although the image of Poland is improving, it's still not really the best, so government should take care of that to improve the image of Poland abroad.
Most analysts here claim that people's high expectations may prove a problem for this government. Stanisław Janecki again.
Every week and every month, people will confront reality and hopes. It would be, I think, a crucial situation for the government. There is nothing more dangerous for the government than high hopes confronted with brutal reality.
And what sort of politician is Poland's new prime minister? Now 50, Donald Tusk describes himself as a stubborn Catholic. A foot soldier in the Solidarity movement in the 1980s, he was one of the founders of the Civic Platform Party 6 years ago, which has consistently promoted liberal economic reforms. He's a great football fan and a good player himself. The trouble is that he's never held any government post before. This is seen by many as a drawback, but according to Łukasz Warzecha of the Daily Fact, while in opposition, Donald Tusk has matured as a politician.
He seems to have gained some power, some trust in himself, self-consciousness, I think. He also has become a harder-minded person, I think. So some features of the character that would be very useful, but what kind of prime minister he will exactly be, we don't know.
Donald Tusk is Poland's 13th prime minister since the collapse of communism. The challenges ahead of him seem to be more difficult than those of his predecessors, if only because President Lech Kaczyński represents a different political camp. The shape of cohabitation, Polish style, will be an important element of Poland's political landscape in coming months. I'm Michał Kubicki reporting for Network Europe.
Well, that's almost all we've got time for, but I promised to let you know who won this month's quiz. I asked you to identify three pieces of music that were among the most popular tunes played at funerals around Europe. In order, they were Frank Sinatra's My Way, Guns N' Roses' November Rain, and Mozart's Requiem. Not so many of you are Guns N' Roses fans, which is perfectly understandable. Congratulations to Chris Murray from County Wicklow in Ireland. Expect a parcel of things in the post. That's it from me. Do tune in next week when Network Europe will be coming to you from Stockholm in Sweden. But from me, Richard Walker, and all of our partners across the continent, thanks very much for listening. But